Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and it's time to sneak our way inside an atrocity. Chris Panettiere's third novel, The Redemption of Morgan Bright, takes us to one of the most fascinating, fearful settings in all of horror, the asylum. Chris's version is as gothic as the best of them, but awful in its own unique way. Now, I'm a huge lover of asylum horror, and I know it's a problematic term, and the necessary caveat awaits you in the main conversation, but it's such fun to pick this trope apart with someone as cheerful and as sensitive as Chris. We talk about the perils of research for an empathetic horror writer, we discuss some hideous medical practices from the past, and we look hard at the desecration of rights that we all grew up assuming were here to stay. But like I said, Chris is a cheerful dude, and he makes all this heavy stuff very palatable. If you enjoy it, if you want more of this kind of thing, sign up for Patreon at patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. You're very welcome amongst my growing band of inmates. You get Discord access, extra episodes every month, loads of good stuff. Also, lovers of the show, if you could leave a glowing review on Apple or Spotify, that'd be great. But now, come with me to a place for the weak and the wounded. Walk the halls and pay attention, because the monsters are not the ones locked away. Let's talk scared. Hello, Chris. Welcome to Talking Scared, mate. How are you?
Hi, Neil. I'm awesome. I'm so glad to be talking to you.
Well, you say that. We're recording this on the 15th of April, which is the Monday after AuthorCon. Have you recovered?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these cons are, they're incredible because we write and we do so much in solitude, and being able to like connect up with people who do the same thing. It's like, I don't know, it's inspiring. It's, you get your juice back, you know, and you're ready to go right and jump into the next thing afterwards, but you're also physically exhausted and in some ways mentally exhausted too. But it was awesome. AuthorCon is fantastic.
Yeah. Get this right for listeners who don't know. It's a sort of 3-day horror writers event, and it's by the charity Scares That Care, right?
That's correct. So it's 3 days. It's a con for authors to come and, you know, sell their books, be on panels, give talks, stuff like that. And for readers to come and meet the writers they want to meet, buy their books, get them signed, get pictures with them, and to interact with them and get a face-to-face. So it's a unique in that respect. And it is also a fundraiser for a charity. It every year, Scares That Care supports 3 different families suffering from different things, and they just give them money. They just straight up give them money, no strings attached. So it's a great cause.
Yeah, definitely. And from your Instagram photos in particular, it looked a damn good time. But I can't imagine that you want to talk for 1 minute about your book, having spent 3 days trying to sell it to people. So thank you.
Well, no, I really do. Because the length at which I spoke with them was to give them an elevator pitch. You know, someone walks up, they ask what it's about. You give them a quick elevator pitch. They make a decision real fast, and they either buy the book or they move on to the next table. So there was no in-depth conversation about this book, which I am actually very enthusiastic and dying to do.
Well, in-depth we can do. No elevator pitches here. I will just say, before we move on from the topic of cons, it's fitting that you speak to me in the immediate aftermath, because we met nearly a year ago exactly at StokerCon. And if listeners want to know the true benefits of attending these things, you know, for all the expense it takes, it's because you get to meet like-minded weirdos like myself and Chris and become strangely firm friends based on less than like sort of 96 hours together. It happens quick, right?
It really does. And I think it's because we share the same interests and we also, you know, certainly from my perspective, when I first met you, I knew your work from listening to your podcast for more than 2 years by that point, probably. And so I felt like I already knew you, and we just kind of jumped right into it, you know, there in the bar at StokerCon, and it was fantastic. And yeah, and then we just stay connected through social media and pay attention to what the others are doing. And that goes for you. That goes for so many people in the horror sphere. It's a wonderful community in that respect.
Yeah. So listeners, get yourself to a con. It's basically like you turn up, don't have to do any small talk. You just leap straight into, this is my favorite scary book, or this awful thing happened to me on the way here. And everyone's just receptive to it. It's great.
That's the best part, is the no small talk. It's just straight to business.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also get to hear about their books. And I have been excited to have you on this show to talk about yours, because we talked about it a year ago. And finally, you know, the TBR rolled around. I got the chance to read it. It covers one of my very favorite tropes, asylum horror. So before we kick on, Chris, introduce us, if you will, to The Redemption of Morgan Bright.
You bet. This one is a contemporary gothic asylum horror story about a woman named Morgan Bright who assumes a false identity and has herself committed in order to try and solve the mystery of her sister's death. So that is the quick elevator pitch for The Redemption of Morgan Bright.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she has a self-committed, voluntarily, under a false name, which will come back to bite in a big way, into this very, very unusual mental institution. And then all manner of oddness ensues. And my question one, Chris, is how the hell does your mind work?
Oh, boy.
I went into this book expecting a fairly traditional gothic tale of madness and misogyny, which it is, but it's so much higher concept than that. And it's up to you how much of the and that you want to go into. But how much of this was in your original plan when you set out to write this story?
That's a great question. I had several original plans for this story, but I would say that when I sat down to write it in earnest, I knew that the fundamental conceit was going to be that a woman would assume a false identity to have herself committed. I needed a reason to have herself committed to explore some of the themes that I go through in the book. And that's where I came to the fact that her sister had also been there and had mm-hmm. been found dead, having apparently escaped it. And what I discovered along the way was that, and this came, I'm a pantser, so I don't really outline, although at some points I had to sit down and kind of figure out how to weave all of the threads of this story together, because it's pretty layered. But what really happened, the most kind of amazing discovery being a pantser, was as I was writing Morgan Bright behaving as Charlotte Turner, the false identity, without my trying, without any intention on my part, Charlotte started to come alive. Charlotte started to have a mind of her own. And when that happened, it was one of those, you could call it a happy accident. You could call it a, one of those just things that happens in the moment where a character does something it wants to do. And boy, did I lean into that. And that really made the story, I think, much more engaging than it would have been if you were in Morgan Bright's head the whole time. In this case, you also get to be in Charlotte's head as she sort of gains primacy over Morgan.
Yeah, because when you say she comes alive, she came alive in the writing, a lot of writers say that the characters came alive. And what most writers mean is that the characters start to dictate the story in some way, you know, that things, unexpected things happen. In your case, that may be true, but also within the novel, she achieves a level of existence that no one expected. It's not just a craft thing, it's a thematic thing. She comes alive, this fictional construct of Morgan's imagination.
You're exactly right. Yeah, there is something about Hollyhock House, which is the asylum, that this construct seems to vibe with. And whether it's something there or something in Morgan's mind that allows this to happen, Charlotte becomes a full person. The only problem is that, of course, there are now two people in the body of Morgan Bright, as far as in her mind. And that's where all the problems happen.
Yeah. I want to come back to that right at the end with a kind of summarizing question that if I asked it now would be unfair to you and unfair to the listeners, because we need the meat on the bone and the clues to get there. So let's park Charlotte for a second. I want to ask a broader question. I often do with this show. I start broad and kind of hone in. But this is your third published novel. You said yourself it's your first horror novel. So let me get this right. You released The Phlebotomist and then you released Stringers, but you began writing Stringers first. Am I right?
You are right. That is absolutely correct. I wrote my very first novel, which, you know, for any aspiring writers, this will probably help you get through any obstacles or any trouble you're having if you're aspiring, which is I wrote a 98,000 word middle grade novel, which is the wrong word count for middle grade, and queried something like 90 agents, had some nibbles, yada, yada. It's on the shelf. Then I began Stringers, what became Stringers. And it was fizzling for me. It was starting to fizzle at about 100 pages. Then something happened in the U.S. where I live, some bad things politically. And I went to bed at night really pissed off and woke up in the morning with the idea for The Phlebotomist, which is a society, a near future dystopian where the society is segregated by blood type. It's yeah. horror adjacent for sure, but I dove in and I wrote The Phlebotomist, and that was then published. And then I came back to Stringers, found my mojo there, and got that book out too.
Right. For argument's sake, then, let's call Stringers your first book, even though it came out second because you started writing it first. So Stringers is a kind of hard sci-fi with comedic elements. The Phlebotomist is that horror adjacent, more societal science fiction. Some would call it soft science fiction with horror elements. And now you've crossed the Rubicon entirely into the land of gothic horror, though I would argue there is still a residue of sci-fi in Morgan Bright. That path is interesting to me. Is there any logic or intent behind it? Hard sci-fi, soft horror, scary sci-fi, horror.
There is. I'm a huge science fiction fan, so I really can't let go of every vestige of it. Although, and maybe we'll talk about this later, because there's a book you and I have talked about that I had an idea for last year that I've now written and is going on sub next month and has no sci-fi in it. It's straight ahead family drama with some supernatural stuff. But the through line for Stringers, The Phlebotomist, and The Redemption of Morgan Bright is that in each one, boy, I really, really, really dive into the core of human nature. I mean, I am just kind of flopping around in that goo in all three books, just in different ways. And so that's my through line. And then, you know, it didn't come out of nowhere that I was going to end up writing horror and sort of finding my voice most in horror. Because if you go to my short stories, ever since I started writing short stories, they're virtually all horror. I think maybe of 25 or so published short stories, maybe two or three are hard sci-fi. The rest are all really either weird or they're straight up horror. And that's kind of where my mind goes, because when I think about human nature, that's just where my mind takes me. So it's not a surprise to me that I ended up there, but I eventually was going to, and now I really feel like I'm hitting my stride in straight up full-throated horror.
Yes, which brings us to Hollyhock Asylum, which is a very, very awful place to spend time, if I'm honest. Although at the start it seems delightful through one character's eyes.
Right.
What took you from the trenches of space to this hospital in the Nebraskan plains? Where did Morgan Bright begin for you?
Well, I wanted to do something in a way that I had not seen done. And I confess that, you know, I have not read the gamut of Gothic literature or asylum literature at all. But I was trying to do something that felt original to me as far as how I would present this place. Mm-hmm. And there are, I think, from the very start, from the introduction where there are two characters driving up to Hollyhock Asylum, there are some very kind of unsubtle nods to Hill House, I think. Mm-hmm. There is something about this place. I wanted to do not just asylum, but there is supernatural in this story. I wanted to have an asylum on a piece of land that is wrong. I wanted to tell a bigger story than just here's an asylum that maybe has bad things going on and bad people doing bad things. I wanted there to be something bigger. I wanted there to be a sense of wonder and mystery to why this place. And so I constructed Hollyhock in a very specific location in the middle of nowhere on a piece of land that I could then invent my own legend for and my own lore for, and then dole out throughout the book. So I wanted to write an asylum story. I wanted to relate it to a lot of our contemporary issues that we currently are facing here in the US and elsewhere. But I also wanted to tell a bigger story where the reader might go, man, there is something else going on here. There are larger forces at work. In a way, there's a little bit of Area X here.
Yes, and I know you're a massive fan of Vandermeer's Annihilation, aren't you?
Yes, huge fan. Well,
and you can see traces. I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, that I seem to constantly refer any book as an element of weirdness or high strangeness. I always say, oh, it's, you know, if you like Annihilation, you'll like this. There is an element of that surrealist end of the strange. But let me tell you what the book I kept thinking of all the way through, right? And I don't know if this has ever been mentioned to you before. One of my favorite books of all time, which is Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go.
I have not heard it, and I have not read that. So I need to read it.
You must read it. I mean, for those who've read Never Let Me Go, it's not the same twist. Don't think you've worked it out at all. You haven't. It couldn't be more different. But the sense of a place being wrong in that way, where it's wrong behind the scenes, it's wrong in a way that even the victims of the wrongness are not fully aware of. And that weird thing about where does the supernatural collide with the science fictional and stuff like that, it feels of a piece with Morgan Bright. So, Chris, you will love it. It's one of the greatest books ever written.
Oh my God. I mean, I've written it down. I mean, I really want to read it now.
It's you will read it and you must message me, because it's like somebody has walked into the room, walked over to you and punched you as hard as they can in the soul and then left.
That's my kind of book. That's my kind of book.
Another thing about Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go is it's a book that's all about bodily autonomy.
Right.
Which I would argue that yours is too. When did you write this book, Chris?
It will be no surprise to you, I'm sure. I wrote it, I began writing it about 2 months after Roe versus Wade was overturned.
Right.
So that was summer of 22, I think. And the idea for this novel had been percolating for a while. And I didn't know what my next novel was going to be, but then that happened. And I think I say it in the acknowledgments or in the afterword, I couldn't write any other book. And I I wanted to write a book that, of course, is story first, but when you get to the end, you see what I put in the afterword, it kind of probably makes a little more sense.
Yeah, one of the things you wrote in the afterword that really struck me was like you wanted to make this issue pertinent to Pete, to more than just those people who have got daughters and can do the math.
Yeah.
And I thought that's really true because I'm a little bit tired and eye-rolly when I see people saying, I have daughters, as if that's the thing you need to have some kind of concern for the state of the world, you know, and,
right.
and how we treat women. It's like, oh, you. So I haven't got daughters, so I'm off the... off the hook, I can do what I want because I've not had a female child. You know, it's a strange way to rationalize this stuff away.
I mean, it's the, you know, we see it all the time with not just women's rights, but we see it with rights of all marginalized people where someone goes, oh my gosh, now I have someone who is a member of this community in my family. Now I care about it. That's the wrong time to start caring about it. I'm glad you do now, right? Congrats on that. But I think that we should care about other people even before it affects us directly. But again, I did not, and I hope I did not, bash people over the head with it. I certainly was hoping to tell a story that stands on its own, but of course it's got some underlying things working.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I keep thinking I'm mentioning science fiction, because it feels like, you know, that really good socially conscious science fiction which can reframe something without having to take on a lecturing tone. That's how it right. feels. I don't think you once make an overt comment about anything political or social beyond the realms of the hospital. But, you know, to anyone who's got any kind of discerning brain and who reads the news, it's there, you know?
Yeah.
One thing I want to ask you, Chris, and it's fine if you... I have a suspicion you won't answer this because you haven't before, but I've got to ask anyway. I've seen you say a few times that you wrote this book because of something your daughter said, but you never say what. Is it a secret or can you tell us?
It's not a secret and it's awesome, actually. So like I said, you know, I had already known that I was, I was already mulling over a asylum tale for several years, actually, before I actually wrote this. What it became changed a lot in the summer of 22, but the idea was already there. And it came from something my daughter said. She was, I think, 4 or 5 at the time. We were driving along through our neighborhood. It was right around Christmas. And my daughter, at that point, had no idea what Star Wars was. No idea. And we happened to drive by. I live in Texas. They say everything's bigger. I guess to an extent this is right, although if you pay any attention to Halloween decorations around the world, they're all getting bigger. There's the 9-foot Home Depot skeleton everybody talks about. But in somebody's front yard, this was actually around Christmas, it had to be 20 feet tall. There was a 20-foot tall Darth Vader blow up, and it had a candy cane lightsaber. And my daughter, we drive by it, and she said, oh, look, it's the Christmas witch. And that phrase, I was like, Christmas witch? The juxtaposition of those two words, I was like, that's so creepy and so just weird and chilling to me. What would a story look like if it was called the Christmas witch? And so I went back and just started writing. I learned about Nellie Bly. I started writing a story about an asylum where there was one of the patients put a curse on somebody right before she was lobotomized. And she said, right before she basically lost her mind, literally said, you know, come Christmas, the witch, basically, I'm cursing you. This witch is going to come and it's going to be my daughter. So it was a weird sort of, those were just the sort of loose ends of it. The only thing that has remained, of course, of that is that there is a character called Christmas in The Redemption of Morgan Bright. And some of the other women like to say that maybe she's a witch.
Yes, she has certain knowledge that could prove useful if only people listen to her.
That's right.
Yeah. Your daughter sounds awesome. I mean, from the mouth of babes, right? Christmas witch.
Yeah.
That is just, yeah, amazing.
Yeah, she is. She's incredible.
But yeah, asylums, why were you drawn to it from the start?
I think a reason a lot of us are drawn to asylums is the fact that we really don't get to look behind the walls, do we? You know, most people probably don't find themselves in a mental institution back in the 1800s or the 1950s mm-hmm. nowadays, right? So there's a mystery to it, and we all love to plow into mystery and see what's happening behind those walls. And so I wanted to explore that. And I did some research. I read a book called Mad Wives, which was actually a scientific study from the 1950s. And it really got my creative juices flowing. But I think at the end of the day, I wanted to try to paint the picture of what's behind those walls in perhaps an unexpected fashion, to bring about a unexpected revelation about one of these places, since we're all so curious about what's there. So I think it's the unknown that makes people really enjoy an asylum tale.
Maybe. I've always loved them. I've always just found it the most, I don't know, iconic, you know, just delicious sort of gothic setting. And you have got to distinguish, like I said, caveat once and move on, because you've got to distinguish between the obvious reality of this and the whole issue around mental health being disconnected from villainy, which I think is a fight that's been long fought. You know, just like we want disability to be disconnected from villainy, mental health and mental illness and mental disability shouldn't be naturally aligned with it. We get all that. But they do remain such delicious places to write about. And what I've noticed in more recent asylum horror is that it is now the institution that's the monster, not the patients.
Of course. Yeah, right. I'm glad we've evolved to that point, right? We don't need to see that story anymore. We don't need to tell that story anymore. I'm not saying no one should. If you've got a compelling story, tell it. But I think it's good to explore the other side of this, because that actually tells a story that has happened. That's part of our history, is that the institutions, you know, especially during a time of rampant experimentation, rampant, secretness, you know, these places were opaque, and there was all sorts of villainy done to people. I think it's good to shine a light on that. And, you know, what I tried to do with Hollyhock House is, of course, this is a contemporary tale. It happens. I never give you the exact date. It's now, it's perhaps near future, you know. But they take a sort of gaslighty approach, don't they? The people who run Hollyhock, they actually make a point of saying, oh, we're not like the old ways, you know, the Magdalene asylums and the way that people, we don't do the cruel things. We're enlightened. And they're very prideful of this, and they put that out front. It may or may not be true.
Yeah, because you kind of have your cake and eat it with this one, Chris, because you find a way to set your book in something like the present, but you still get to play with the misogyny and the disempowerment that underpins the history of these places, both in fiction and reality. Can you talk, to whatever extent you're happy to, spoiler-wise, about that mid-century feel that you managed to evoke in this asylum?
Yeah, sure. So I mixed my time periods a little bit. I'm sure you notice you're an extremely perceptive reader, a discerning reader. I framed the actual sort of environment and the treatments, for the most part, framed those around the 1950s. And we're seeing that, I think, kind of making a little bit of a comeback. Perhaps it's just the natural ebb and flow of how trends work. But I centered some of that around the 1950s, because to the extent that our real world is pivoting at all, it seems to be pivoting in that direction. But also, you know, everybody in this story has a name I pulled straight from the Victorian era, because there are, you know, they all have these crazy names. And there are other features of this asylum. And of course, now it's just called Hollyhock House. It used to be called you know, Nebraska State Lunatic Asylum, but that was the old outdated name. And I took some things that were far older than the 1950s and brought those back because in a way I wanted to show us how delicate our circumstance is at all times when it comes to how patients are treated, when it comes to how human beings are treated. And that things like, you know, patients' rights and transparency and all of that, those are constructs. Those exist because we have pushed them to exist, not necessarily because the institutions want them to exist. And it's a very delicate balance. And so I kind of took us to the 50s, but I also took us to a place a little bit further back.
Well, you've absolutely nailed there what I think is the frightening essence of this book. It made me think about how people my age and your age, I mean, you're like 5 minutes older than me, growing up in the wake of, you know, the Cold War peace dividend and all of that stuff, you know, grew up in the 90s. We've grown up with things just getting better and better and better for most people. I know, you know, right, there's obvious complexity, but, you know, for most people in the Western democracies, things have got better. And then sometime since 2016, it started to go backwards, or at least there started to be a push backwards. And it's just a weird thing to think, to live a life where you think it's linear and teleological and everything is heading towards some kind of sunlit upland. And all of a sudden, like you say, that the stark realization that all of this stuff is a construct and it's predicated on human beings not losing the trajectory to push forward, or certainly not wanting to go backwards. It's a completely constructed standard that isn't inalienable. You know, it's not, these are not fundamental inalienable rights. They're things that we choose to adopt and support or not. And the books, to me, is all about that.
Right. I'm trying to present a scenario, you know, within this horror story about, hey, you know, it doesn't take much for us to go backwards. It just, it takes a lack of attention and it takes somebody pushing us that way. And that if you assume that just because you have certain rights now, you will always have them, that is a fool's errand. Mm. We have to work to protect these things.
Yeah. I mean, Morgan stroke Charlotte, because there's complexity right from the start over who's who.
Yep.
They're either given or they adopt this diagnosis to enter Hollyhock, and they call it domestic psychosis. Is that a real condition? Was it ever used as such, or did you invent it?
No, that's an invention. But it's a combination of a number of different diagnoses that women were given primarily in the 1950s. You know, schizophrenia was the overarching label given to women in the 1950s suffering, well, shoot, nearly any from any malady or no malady at all. It was this extremely broad brush that was used to say, oh, you're just schizophrenic. Or they would say that you are diagnosed within the schizophrenogenic milieu, whatever that is, right? And so I did what many of these practitioners were doing. I made it up. I made up domestic psychosis as something that was related to what they were doing in the 1950s and before, right? Mm-hmm. We had hysteria, we had vapors, we have all these just ambiguous made up things that people attached to women, whether they were suffering from them or not. And so, look, this is contemporary. I wanted to say, well, look, what if there's the next thing, right? What's the next thing that we're going to use to control women through diagnoses, right? And that's where domestic psychosis comes from.
And in the dichotomy of Morgan and Charlotte, you get, I don't know how to put it, you sort of get two takes on womanhood in opposition, don't you? Like yin and yang. So like Morgan is a modern woman with a very modern perspective. Like she doesn't want to have kids and there's problems in her past and stuff, but she's largely self-determined. And then there's Charlotte, who is a sort of paragon of, you know, white bread American female virtue, whatever that fucking means. Do you know what I mean? But it feels you're poising them as one of them sees the horror of this domestic psychosis, of the idea of it, and the other one is almost embracing it as a sort of course of self-betterment.
Right. Well, so remember, so Morgan has herself committed to this place, and the way she does that is by creating this persona of Charlotte Turner. And she wants Charlotte Turner to be the type that causes no waves, right? That once she's in this place, she kind of disappears and just fits in, so that presumably Morgan can go about her sort of clandestine investigation to see what happened with her sister, right? That's the whole reason she's doing it, is something has happened in the past. Morgan feels great guilt, so she creates Charlotte as a cover to go inside. And she has created, she believes, a very two-dimensional character in Charlotte. This is someone who is just, you're right, the good 1950s style, obedient housewife. That's Charlotte. And that's who Charlotte is when she starts. But Charlotte, too, evolves. Something speaks to her about this place. And she realizes that Hollyhock offers her what she's always wanted, which I won't get that much into. But really, Charlotte is there because she wants to heal. She really does believe that she has domestic psychosis. And she's willing to do whatever the doctors say to heal so that she can have a family.
Do you consider her a villain in the story?
I don't. It's so interesting. I think that as I have gotten older and my eyes have been open, I mean, God, I was a little shit in college, you know? God, I thought I knew everything, right? I mean, I came up in the 90s. I had some stupid ideas. And as my eyes have been open to other perspectives and how other people live and the things other people go through, my understanding, my empathy for the plight of others is extremely deep now. And I think for Charlotte, she is literally a victim of circumstance. She was constructed by Morgan to be the way she is. Mm. And she's only doing what her programming, as she was programmed by her creator, to do. And so from her perspective, she's only doing what she was made to do. And if Morgan happens to get in the way, well, that's too bad.
Yeah. Did it ever worry you writing such a female-centric story as a guy? I'm thinking of one scene in particular, actually, which is, it's quite an horrific scene, which is, it's a kind of rape. It's like Morgan is forced to have an orgasm. It's a kind of call back to the Victorian idea of, you know, hysteria and stuff like that, all that nonsense that used to go on back in the day. And I was reading it thinking, this must have been something you were writing with real nervousness.
Neil, I wrote the whole story with nervousness. I was anxious about writing the entire thing. Whose story is it to tell, right? That question haunted me through this writing this entire thing. And I think the answer is, it is the story of anyone who cares about these issues to tell it. I think that's the answer. It is my responsibility to do everything within my power to tell it as accurately and as genuinely as possible, to remove all male perspective from myself as much as I can, and try to get into the head of these characters as much as I can, and to do these situations and these circumstances absolute justice as best as I can. And so far, what I've heard from readers is that I've largely been able to do that. And I'm very relieved, because yes, there are some brutal scenes here. And I'll tell you that my editor, this particular scene you're talking about, which in psychological circles is called identity stripping, It's a invoked trauma to try to weaken a person and to try to make them servile and docile. And when I turned in the manuscript to my editor, she actually flagged this scene and she said, "Chris, don't hold back. Do what you have to do for the scene and for the story." And that gave me the confidence to make it what it became. Mm. And I think that's because Gemma, my editor, who's wonderful, I think because she understood that I was doing everything I could to tell this story with the amount of respect and I guess genuine approach as I could.
I mean, there was no point where I thought, oh, that's, you know, a crass way of putting it, or that's a very male gaze. And I'm always looking for that kind of stuff, because I'm always reading these books with an eye on the interview, you know, so I'm looking actively. And that scene, I remember thinking, like, that is a brave thing to write, because it could so easily have tipped over into the salacious. Or, you know, there's a whole subgenre of essentially like low-grade pornographic horror from the 70s and 80s about women trapped together in institutions who devolve into kind of rabid lesbianism. And it's, you know, this gross reduction, you know, of these stories to something else. And obviously you didn't do that, but there was no hint of the salacious, you know.
I appreciate that. And, you know, in fact, I believe in that scene, you know, Morgan is... she's there as it's happening, and the scene has a purpose, which is extremely important to say. That scene serves a purpose and is vital to the fork in the road, speaking, so to speak, of Morgan and Charlotte. But Morgan, as it's happening and she's reflecting on it, you know, she talks about how she's being reduced, right? How she's being assessed and made an object. The last thing I will ever do in any of my writing is just go, oh, well, here we need a salacious scene of X, Y, or Z happening with women. If it doesn't serve the purpose. So in this case, I did it for many reasons. It's historically correct, first of all. This is something that was done to women. And two, it serves a plot point in the story to move it forward.
Yeah, it's horrific. and it spins everything we think we know about what we think is our main character on its head. So it's a real sleight of hand as well. So yeah, well, round of applause on that one. As grim as it is, you know. You said a thing a moment ago, in my ears prick up. You said, this is the story of anyone who cares. And it's just dawned on me that, I could be wrong, you're a trial attorney, is that right?
That's right.
Do you think, I could be putting words in your mouth, but do you think that that's played a part in you wanting to write about injustice in this novel?
1,000%. Because I always represented people, right? And generally I represented people who were poisoned or got cancer as the result of some corporation not giving a shit. And truly just putting profit over safety or caring about people. I mean, all you have to do is look around now and see it. You know, I'm flying a 737 MAX 8 Boeing aircraft home today. So cross my fingers, right? I certainly have loved being a trial lawyer and practicing as a trial lawyer, but the dark side of it is I have seen the documents of hundreds of companies. And it has given me a very grim outlook on just how people are treated when there's a power differential. And so I've always been a hyper empathetic person to the point of tears. And then seeing it in my day job makes me see it everywhere. And sometimes I wish I could just shut off my perceptions for a little bit, because it can be a little bit crippling. And I know that I'm not saying anything that isn't common to people who love to read and write, because I think you have to kind of be an empathetic person to do either of those things.
Yeah, well, empathy is a curse when you write about this kind of stuff, right? I mean, did the research upset you? Did it get to you? Because I can't imagine it's fun.
It did. And I'll tell you that the thing that got to me the most was watching old interviews from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, from these psychological interviews, and, you know, with typically a woman and a male doctor, a woman sitting there on a couch or a chair, smoking a cigarette, looking entirely defeated, and being led through questions by the doctor, not asked open-ended questions, but led to say whatever the doctor wanted them to say, to achieve whatever result the doctor wanted to achieve during those time periods. I don't believe they were all malicious. I certainly don't. But I do believe that there was rampant experimentation, and there was also rampant use of study subjects to try and prove a method or prove a point that the doctor wanted proven. And they did it by leading these patients down a path and just seeing the defeat of these women sitting there, just agreeing to make it stop. That broke my heart. That utterly broke my heart. And I channeled some of that feeling into what was happening in this story as well.
I bring it up all the time that my mum is a psychiatric nurse, and in the 70s and 80s worked in a institution here in the UK in Manchester, and she worked with geriatric patients. And you ask my mum and she'll tell you this institution was, you know, it looked like a Victorian asylum, and in many ways it operated like one. And she talks about nursing elderly women who had spent their entire adult lives in an institution because they had a child out of wedlock.
Yeah, my God.
Just a life stolen. It's just, you know, I was going to say it's insane. It sounds like a pun, you know, but it is.
Right.
It's nuts on a whole nother level.
It is. And again, it's, you know, that's not so far in the past, is it, Neil? Right. Mm. And there is this mistake that people make to think, well, it's in the past. The past is the past. We can never come back to that. And that's so wrong. You have to protect what you have.
Yeah. It's a theme we keep spinning on today, that, right? Yeah. Talk about empathy, things that brought you to tears, things that upset you. Did you ever come across the Titicut Follies?
I didn't.
You know, it's not a recommendation, because it there's nothing to gain apart from disquiet and discomfort. But the Titicut Follies is a documentary, and it was in the 60s, and I think the director was called Wiseman. He basically filmed just raw footage at Bridgewater State Hospital, which I think was in Massachusetts. And it's the most upsetting thing I've ever seen.
Oh, God, that sounds horrific. Yeah. It sounds terrible.
I mean, it still gets shown at film festivals. You know, I mean, I can't remember the details. It was a landmark thing in the States, and it was either the first film that was banned under certain regulations, or it was the most banned. You know, there's a lot of controversy around it. But they let him loose. And here's the awful part. The phrase Titicut Follies is... The Titicut comes from the native name for a local river close to the asylum. And the Follies is because they used to do talent shows with these inmates who were unwashed, left to sleep on rags in corners, unmedicated, walking around naked, covered in, you know, filth. And this was in the 60s.
Yeah. That, you know, it's interesting you bring up the talent shows, because in the 1950s, in Carol Warren's Mad Wives book, these institutions would do beauty pageants and they would do talent shows. And in fact, I wove some of that into this story as well. And I just think to myself how awkward and strange and potentially dehumanizing. I wasn't there, you know, so, but it sounds like what you're describing is incredibly dehumanizing.
Yeah, I don't recommend people watch it. Like I say, there's nothing to gain there that's going to make you feel better about the world at all. But it is a it's a landmark piece of media, you know, that I unfortunately made myself watch for research once for a project I was working on, and I wish I hadn't. I mean, before we move on from this horrendous stuff, because it is a horror podcast, I sometimes feel guilty, right? Like I shouldn't dwell on the stuff. And it's like, I've invited a horror novelist on to talk about his book about these things. I can't not talk about them. It's a weird thing, you know. Let's talk about the nice stuff. but you do include some details of really cruel, archaic, hopefully archaic treatments in the story. And I'm almost loath to ask, Chris, but is the Utica crib a real thing?
Utica crib is real.
Oh my, tell my listeners about the Utica crib, because fucking hell.
Yeah, the Utica crib came from an asylum in Utica, New York. And the Utica crib is imagine a baby crib, but then take the chamber of the baby crib, right? The walls, the slatted walls, and cut it to about a third of its height. So now it's very shallow, and then put a lid on it and remove all mattresses, all of that. So it's slats on the bottom, slats on the side, slats across the top with a hinged lid. And this is something where I think the name of the, I included in the book actually, when Morgan is talking about the Utica crib, that history that she is giving is the accurate history of the Utica crib. And I believe the inventor was named Bingham, was the director of this Utica asylum. They would take people and put them into this crib, lock them inside. They were so shallow that you couldn't roll over. Whichever way you were put into it, it was like a flat iron, right? If you're like a sandwich in a flat iron, that's exactly what would happen. And you couldn't roll over, you couldn't turn. And they were so bad that within 3 years, enough doctors at this turn of the century asylum voiced their concern about it, that they stopped using them. Something's got to be really, really bad if at the turn of the century they say, no, this is so bad we have to stop using it. So that's the Utica crib. It's pretty terrible.
It's not a nice thing to think about. And the history you paint of it and certain cases, not one for the faint-hearted.
No.
But the absolute scariest part of the book for me was to do with this practice called the calming. And I won't give too much away, but it involves the invocation of a certain mental state to do with sensory deprivation. And Morgan at one point says, aside from the surface of the chair, there's nothing to tell me I exist. And she has this existential panic that she could still be in the chair and dreaming whatever she thinks is her reality, you know? And it reminded me of Gemma Moore's book, Full Immersion, which I couldn't read because of the existential dread it arose in me. And this, you know, the calming in your book does a similar thing. But all that worry about existence and identity is at the core of the book, which brings us finally again to Charlotte, who we haven't really pushed beyond the basics of yet. And, well, I want to talk about the fact that you basically snuck a possession story inside my guard without warning me. Is that fair? Is this a possession story?
That is fair, Neil, but I will take one issue with what you said, because it was in the bar at StokerCon. You were saying how possession stories really got under your skin, and you were in the middle of drinking a glass of wine. I said, hey, by the way, you don't have to read The Redemption of Morgan Wright. There's a little possession in there. And you went, oh, no, it's fine.
See, I get very brave when I drink, Chris. This is a problem.
Well, so yeah, you're exactly right. This is a possession story as well. And the twist, of course, and it's not much of a twist, it's on the back cover copy. The twist, of course, is that Morgan becomes possessed by an identity of her own creation. And I had not seen that before done in that way. And so, yes, this is a possession story as well.
So I'm going to ask you the final question about Charlotte. And you may not want to answer because it may be too, I don't know, defining. I don't know. But what is she? Because she can't just be Morgan's mental invention, can she? She can't just be, because she's so powerful. Is she a result of Morgan's guilt? You know, because the title is The Redemption of Morgan Bright. We also find out that the very ground that Holyoak is built on has special properties, so she could be some kind of genus loci. At the end, Morgan calls her a demon. What is she, in your opinion?
She is something greater than just Morgan's invention. She is something greater than just a thing that lives in her head. Very early on, when Morgan is talking to the detective, because there are sections of the book that are transcript, mm-hmm. she says, no, there was something there. There was something about Holyoak that spoke to Charlotte that made her so much more than just a construct in my mind. So to the extent that helps clarify that, yeah, she's real.
And I'm now wondering, and I don't expect an answer, I'm just thinking out loud, I'm wondering whether whatever she is was always there, and she's just been given the contours of Charlotte because Morgan has arrived. And if someone else had arrived, she'd be a different thing. Or whether it's that Morgan has brought something that Holyoak has the power to invest with a different kind of reality. And
I like the way you put it in the second, the latter there, which is that Holyoak, as you learn as the story goes on, you know, Holyoak is almost like an amplifier.
Mm.
The more you learn about Morgan's history and her past, you know, she's got a lot to work out and she's buried a lot. And Charlotte isn't all bad. She's pretty bad. As far as it goes from Morgan's perspective, Charlotte's pretty bad. But Charlotte has access to a lot of the things that Morgan has buried. And Charlotte, because Holyoak has helped amplify her to reality, presents Morgan with some of these things. And so you learn a little bit more about Morgan towards the end and a few little twists that sort of come in near the end of the book.
And that brings us back, as most conversations on this show do, to Hill House, which is also a kind of psychic amplifier. People, go back and listen to my deep dive with Paul Tremblay and Kat Ward and Johnny Compton on to Hill House, where we talk about how you bring your ghost to Hill House and it invests them with power. They're not there waiting for you. So
that's a great
episode,
by the way. That's a great episode. I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's quite a profound thing to talk about there, like psychic states and amplifiers and haunting and all that. But now I want to talk about hot dogs. You know, your hot dog mayo milkshake, because I called you names, Chris, for the possession thing. And then you talk about this game between Morgan and her sister where they have to outdo each other, a doozy. And one of them drinks a milkshake made of hot dogs and mayo. And when I read it, I gipped, which means in Mancunian slang, it means I retched. To gip means to retch. And then I literally said out loud to an empty room, oh, you fucking prick.
This is amazing. This is so great. I love that you've flagged the doozy where Hadley and Morgan were trying to outdo each other. That's fantastic. I apologize for your gip, but not really.
Yeah, yeah. I literally swore at you from 1,000 or something miles away. Just nothing. I'm impervious to nausea. But the hot dog mayo milkshake, oh my God, I nearly died.
That's so awesome.
Before we finish up, I want to ask you very briefly about music, because it plays quite a big part in your creative life, right?
It does, yes.
So talk to me about how your writing, your illustration, and your musical tastes interact.
Thanks. That's a really great question. And the answer is they very much do. But it's not just a matter of, you know, listening to music and being inspired by it, because, you know, generally when I write, I can write with music, but not with lyrics or anything, or a really good riff, because I'll get drawn into it and then I'll start headbanging. You know, I look to music as a fan of those who want to press their creativity to the ultimate limits, right? I've used this analogy before of, you know, there are certain musicians, certain bands that I really admire because they, you know, they paint to the corners. So, you know, if you paint a room, a wall in a room, and you use a roller brush, you've covered 99.9% of the surface, but have you really squeezed all the juice out of it, right? Did you paint to the corners? And there are certain bands that I just love so much because no matter who's listening or how many, you know, how many tens of people come to their concerts or whatever, they are just out there pushing their creative boundaries as far as they possibly can. And, you know, some of those bands I just really look to and try to do the same thing when I write and when I draw, because I'll do album art for them. I'll do book covers for people. And when I do it, I try to juice everything I can out of the creative fodder I'm given to present the best piece of art. And I do that as well when I'm writing. You know, there are some really vivid scenes in this book that I worked at to try and paint to the corners on, to get every bit out of them that I could creatively while staying within the lane of the story, you know, not going outside mm-hmm. the lines and pulling you out of it. So yeah, I mean, I really go back and forth between music, art, and my reading and writing. They're all one and the same really for me, creatively.
Yeah. What we haven't made clear, Chris, is that you're into the most extreme metal.
Yeah, I am. I really am into metal, and it's funny because, you know, if you take somebody and drop them into the middle of a metal album, often they'll say, "Why is it so angry? Why is it so loud and mean?" But if they only knew that 3/4 of metal music, they're really just singing about goblins returning from battle with orcs, you know, or pirates, you know, looting on the high seas. I mean, it's one of the reasons I love metal so much is there's a genre for everybody. There literally is pirate metal. There is Viking metal. There's troll metal. These are just nerds. I mean, metal is the horror genre of music.
Yeah. I remember sitting with you in Pittsburgh, and this is going to sound patronizing. I really don't mean to be. You're a very sweet man. You know, you've got a little sunshiny smile on your face. You know, you just like... obviously and externally a nice guy, and then you're sitting there talking to me about like these bands with names that I can't even remember, and I'm not some prude. I mean, I don't care, you know, the shit I'm into, like books and films and stuff, but I have never felt so far out of my depth as talking to you about metal.
You know, I think that metal is also a way for people to, you know, just like any type of music that somebody likes, you listen to it because you like the sound, you like the story, but also there's a big therapeutic piece of it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think that people become one with the music that they really, really love, and it helps them work something out. I mean, I'm listening to a band right now. Talk about names you can't pronounce. It's called Shyla Magognar. And I love them, and I have no idea what they're singing about. Don't understand any of the lyrics, no idea, but boy, the music is great and I really love to rock out to it.
That sounds like it involves goblins for sure.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Shyla Magognar? Yeah, for sure.
It sounds like a football chant of like Mordor FC or something, you know?
Yeah, it does.
I sound like I'm being like dismissive. It's people like what they like. I've just never been able to get into it. But you know, I might try just for you, Chris.
Well, I can give you some introductory stuff whenever you're ready.
Yes. Introductory being the key word there. I have a friend who's into all this stuff as well, and he's tried before and we've never quite gone to plan. Before we finish, we keep talking about me, you and I meeting and talking at StalkerCon. It must sound like a really cringy, you know, oh, we had a nice time in Pittsburgh on our summer holidays thing. But one of the things that I've been following ever since then is the story idea you told me about and you referenced at the start of this conversation. And I don't know how much you can say, but it was a beautiful thing. You were on a panel, or you were sitting in a panel that I was on. Yes, that was it. It was the Tropes panel. And you came out and you told me you had this idea for a story. And it was the most perfect kernel of an idea for a story. And watching you write it and work on it, and it's been a delight. Where are we up to with it? What can you say about it?
Well, Neil, you know, it's funny because I walked up to you afterwards and I said, look, you've read a lot more than I have. But I could read a lifetime and probably not catch up with you ever. So I ran this idea by you. I said, has anybody done that? And you said, write it down, tell nobody. And I did. I did. I wrote the whole novel. We are probably going to go out with it on submission next month. So hopefully it strikes an editor at a publisher the same way that it struck you. It's tentatively called Worry Box. It's about basically a house that is a bit kind of a jealous sibling and sees one of the children as a danger to the rest of the family.
Just a phenomenal idea. And I heard you talk about some of its finer points, which I'm sure have changed and morphed and twisted since then. But just, it was an idea that came to you with such clarity. You had to write it. It was too streamlined and ready to roll off the starting block. So I'm glad that you did, because I really, really want to read that story.
Well, I hope everybody can read it. I have my fingers crossed. I hope it hits with an editor somewhere. But it was, man, I had the confidence as soon as you were like, go write that right now. Mm-hmm. And I did. I started writing it that day at StokerCon, sitting in a chair in the lobby as Swifties were rolling by. And I finished it a few months later. And now I've revised it several times. And hopefully it's in the best shape it can be in for submission.
Awesome. Well, keep me informed. And obviously, open invite to come back on whenever that or anything else gets published. But that one I really want to talk about.
Great, Neil. Thank you.
Perfect segue into the closing questions. Can you recommend somebody else's book that you think my listeners should check out?
I absolutely can. Is it okay if I do too?
Because it's you, Chris. Go on, yeah. Go on.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Very quickly then. So one of them comes out tomorrow. So it will be out by the time this episode goes up. But it's The House at the End of Laislene Street by Catherine McCarthy. She's there in Wales. This is a novella. It's a fantastic, masterful gothic, spooky, extremely, I say masterful because you could just feel how much control Catherine has over it. It's not terribly scary, but it is spooky and it's just super interesting. So it's a quick read. I highly recommend it. And the second book is one of the books that has creeped me out ever since I read it. I don't see it referenced many places. It's The Grip of It by Jack Jemp. And I hope I'm saying that right. It's J-A-C-J-E-M-C, The Grip of It. That book scared the ever-living shit out of me.
Right. Two things. One, I really want to read Catherine's novella because I love interesting. I think I like interesting more than scary. Right. Yeah. All the things I love about this genre is the interesting, not the scary. It's like, oh, I want to know what the secret of that house is and what happened back in 1923 and, you know, that sort of stuff. Way more than the scares. So I want to check that out, definitely. And it's a novella, which is useful for me because I have no time. The Grip of It is a book I quit on and I never DNF books. But this was pre-Talking Scared, so I gave myself more leeway. And I didn't finish it because I just didn't get what it was. It seemed too obtuse and cold. And are you saying I should go back and give it another go? Was I wrong?
Well, you're right in some ways. You know, it's funny because there's a lot about, you know, we get a great burst of, I don't know, maybe it's serotonin, endorphins. It's some good, positive, burst of energy when we really connect with characters and we really love the story and you don't want to stop talking about it. Well, Jack Jemp does the opposite with The Grip of It. It is a cold story. It is bleak. And it is, I think every now and then, at least for me, I need a little bit of that. That book is a hard reset, a hard, cold reset. And that house and that next door neighbor are utterly terrifying to me in that story. So this is a book that is both interesting because, yeah, it does not It does not tell you what's going on. You're not going to finish that book and go, oh, I get it. It was all tied up for me. But if you need a cold, hard punch to the face that might scare the crap out of you, that's the book. And it sticks with me, even though I didn't finish it and say, oh, wow, what a wonderful experience. But it stuck with me. And props to anybody who can write a book that really sticks with you long-term, and that one has.
Okay. Well, that's good enough for me. I shall try at some point in the future to try it again, because I've got a copy somewhere. I just need to find it and find the time.
Right.
Well, my last question, Chris, and I imagine this is going to be a good one from you. What was the last thing that really scared you?
Well, I have an extremely active imagination. This is a blessing and a curse. The last thing that scared me was, and I don't get super scared by books a whole lot, but every now and then there is an image that sticks with me. And two recent books I've read have done this to me. One is Laurel Hightower's The Day of the Door, and the other is Johnny Compton's The Spite House. And I know you've read The Spite House. And there is some imagery in that book, in the shadows. Things appearing in the shadows. And there is, in my bedroom, there is a particular shadow in the corner that I sure see a whole lot of stuff in. I also have sort of hypnagogic, twilight of sleep, sort of visions and things. And I swear 2 weeks ago, I thought I heard something march out of that shadow and come right over me in the bed. And I flipped over in the bed and threw my arms out to stop whatever it was. That hasn't ever happened. And it happened like 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
That's the last time I was scared. And of course, you're really defenseless when you're falling asleep, right? Mm-hmm. But I will also add, because you brought this up a few weeks ago, and for months, Neil, I have been going, oh, when he asked this question, I've got the answer, because you used to say what truly scares you. And I have an answer. And then you brought it up a few weeks ago. Let me tell you what truly scares me on a day-to-day basis. And that is holes, closely spaced holes. It's called like tropophobia, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you show me a lotus pod and I'm going to try to punt you into the sun. Like, do not show me closely spaced holes together, because I believe that I've got tropophobia. But it's so funny. Ever since you mentioned that, I was like, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, this is a completely new one on me. So I didn't know that existed. And then somebody in my family, it turns out, has it. And here's what I always like to say to people who have this, particularly people who are non-British. Do you know what a crumpet is?
Yeah, isn't it like a type of like sweet biscuit or cookie or something?
No. I'm not going to say anymore. Okay. It's a kind of breakfast snack. It's like I don't know what the hell it is. It's a kind of unrisen dough thing. But you say, now. Go and Google a crumpet and imagine eating one.
Oh, great. So you're trying to trigger me here before I get on the plane. No, I'll do it. I'll do it, Neil. Yeah. I'm very brave.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. And as for the books you mentioned, The Spite House is amazing. That corridor, that floating corridor, yes, off the bedroom. Oh, God, never going in there. And you're the second person in recent weeks to recommend Laurel Hightower's Day of the Door. So maybe I need to hunt a copy of that down.
Again, that's it's a novella. It's a quick read, just like Catherine McCarthy's book. And Laurel can evoke some imagery, some absolutely creepy imagery. And, they're both afternoon reads, so they're pretty quick.
And I have a holiday coming up soon, so perfect timing. Right, well, you've talked about a lot of books there. It's a nice little shoehorn in for some good people. Your book will be out live, out in the ether, for people to read when this goes live, when this episode lands. So everyone, you've heard us talking about this, The Redemption of Morgan Bright. I mean, there's just so much to love in there, and so much we haven't even talked about that you couldn't predict from any of this conversation. So listeners, I hope you check it out. And Chris, I hope you have a nice trip back home. I hope the doors stay on your Boeing jet. That'd be good for everyone. But thanks ever so much for talking scared, and I'll see you soon.
Neil, thank you so much. You're an absolute angel. I love listening to you week to week and hanging out with you when we have the chance. You're such a big part of this community. Please never stop, but don't wear yourself out. But thank you so much for having me.
I'll leave that in so everyone hears how much you love me. I always like to. A better person with a less needy ego would edit that stuff out of the conversation, but I'll leave that in there. Okay.
Don't edit that out. I absolutely forbid it.
Okay. Yeah, it's his fault, listeners. It's not my ego. It's Chris's orders. Okay. See you later, man. These episodes are getting longer again. 1 hour and 15 that one clocked in at. The next two are just as long. I promise this is not a loosening of editorial restraint, because you know I worry about that. It's just that the guests are too damn interesting and often too inspiring. And I sit there recording it knowing I should say goodbye, but I find myself asking just one more question, then another. I hope you don't mind. I hope you stuck with it. And I hope you stick with this book, to be honest, because it is taxing on the old brain, but it ain't half worth the early struggle. Struggle's too far. It's not a struggle, but it's a challenge, this book, to get to grips with, to find your feet when you're reading it. And we didn't really talk much in that conversation about Chris's writing style, because there was too much broader contextual stuff to discuss. But he has this really assured but often densely poetic way of getting a point across. And Morgan Bright reaches at times into overt surrealism in places. And because of the mental state of the characters, it can be difficult to discern if Chris is describing reality or imagination or some other liminal state of being in those moments. And that could easily have been a frustration for a reader like me. But, like I say, Chris does it so confidently and so well that it actually succeeds. Like the strange edges of this book, the strange parts that I'm not sure how to tie into a neat bow, that they're great in a way that a lot of writing like this isn't. And then there's all the stuff that we talked about, the bouncing between gothic trope and the other things. It's a very original book, this one, and I applaud it. Also, I should mention something he told me about that I'd missed. There are some excerpts in the book from fabricated newspaper reports, and one contains a link to a website, welcometohollyhock.com. Turns out Chris actually made that website and you can visit it. I haven't yet, but I'm going to. And I love stuff like that, and I'm so glad he told me, because reading at the pace I do for the show means I often miss some of those little details. One quick piece of advice. If you're intrigued by asylum horror, if this episode tweaked your brain in the right way, go and watch the movie Session 9. It's one of the greatest, most subtle and slow-burning horror movies ever made. It's set and actually filmed in the actual Danvers State Asylum, which is kind of like the Ur Asylum, the essence of haunted American institution. And Session 9 is where I got that phrase from in the intro, the weak and the wounded. It's my favourite line from any horror movie ever, my number one line. You'll have to watch the film to understand why. I did a big discussion of Session 9 on the This Is Horror podcast, but maybe I should do one myself. Maybe a chat about that and Late Mungo, two films that inspire a lot of horror writers. Yeah, let me know what you think about that one. But do go and watch Session 9. I also stand by my comparison to Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go. It's more a tonal comparison than a plot link between Morgan Bright and Never Let Me Go. Either way, though, that's high praise from me, because Never Let Me Go is one of the best books I've ever read. I mean, have you read it? And do you, like me, consider it a horror novel? It's quiet horror. For sure, it's somber, it's tragic, but it's true horror in its implications. If you haven't read it, then just like my suggestion of Session 9, and just like my suggestion of Any Human Heart on last week's episode, I suggest you get to it very soon. But don't watch the Keira Knightley adaptation of Never Let Me Go first, because it's okay as a film, but it's a weak, a tear-rated imitation of the book. Lots of suggestions this week. Sorry to inundate you. The last thing I will say about this week's episode is that cons really are worth going to. And I hope my friendship with Chris is some proof of that. All the things we said are true. You just bond quickly because you get right to the heart of the things you both love. And they do cost a lot, sure, but if you can afford it, they are nourishing for the horror-loving soul. I'm off to StokerCon at the end of May, probably the last time for a while, unless they introduce a podcast award and I get nominated. But if you're going, let me know. We can maybe try and grab a coffee or something. I spent the last one walking around telling people that, oh, we must catch up later, and they're never actually doing it. I hope to be better this year. So drop me an email about that, or books, or favourite asylum horror, whatever, talkingscaredpod@gmail.com, or find me on social media at talkscaredpod. Insta, Twitter, and Threads are the main places that I lurk. And if you come and find me soon, you can join in with me in tormenting Chris with images of crumpets and food with holes in them. The Patreon's there if you want ever more content. Loads of stuff on there, including the whole Nat Cassidy, Bruce Springsteen chat, and the latest installment of Hushed Tones, which is the candid book reviews that I do for Patreons. Go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod and many, many thanks. I'm back next week with a quite unusual episode, actually, with Robert O'Tone. We're talking about his parenthood horror novel, The Vile Thing We Created, which I really loved and which has just turned a year old. And the episode is quite different because it's way less disciplined and less organised than I normally am. We start just chatting, and then I get a bit forthright and maybe a tad obnoxious on certain topics, and I blame Robert for bringing that out of me. So listening to that for a bit of a change of pace, and hopefully you'll still like me afterwards. But until then, stay open to new friendships, listen to music that makes your heart pound, and keep pushing the world forward. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.